From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. President Trump's cabinet shakeups just keep coming. The latest involves the Department of Veterans Affairs. The president has nominated his White House doctor, Ronnie Jackson, to replace Dr. David Shulkin as VA secretary. The firing comes weeks after an inspector general's report that was highly critical of the secretary for an official trip he made to Europe last year. He brought along his wife and paid for her travel with agency funds. Shulkin told NPR's Morning Edition today that the trip was mainly work, not vacation, and that all the expenses were approved of ahead of time. He also questioned whether changing VA leadership now will really help the department.
I do think in any organization where you're making such big change, continuity of leadership is important. So I do think that this is going to be a challenge going forward.
Lisa Ryan covers the federal government for The Washington Post. And Lisa, before we talk about the future for military veterans, what about David Shulkin's tenure at VA? Has he made any progress toward reforming the department and fixing what are considerable problems there?
Hi, Lisa. Well, I think that Dr. Shulkin was widely viewed as having made enormous progress in just a year. The Congress passed 11 bills to reform the agency, which is, more bills for one agency than Congress has really done for any other agency. One of them had to reform the appeals process for benefits, which is suffering from huge backlogs. Another was setting up a White House hotline for people, potentially suicidal veterans to call. Another was a big, big accountability bill that the president really wanted, clearing a faster path for the secretary to fire people who are not high performers, who have been involved in misconduct. The secretary was restructuring, trying to figure out ways to dispose of empty buildings. And then there was the biggest thing that he was doing, there were two of them. One is to completely modernize the VA's antiquated electronic health record systems and sync them up with the Defense Department's and with those of private doctors. That contract, priority of the administration's, was ready to be signed this week, and the secretary had negotiated it for months. That will now clearly be delayed.
And was there one other?
Sorry. The other has to do with the biggest kind of hot button issue now at VA, which is the degree to which veterans are allowed to seek private care, through private doctors outside the system.
And he had made some headway on that, but he was against the entire privatization of VA. So where does that bring us with his potential replacement anyway, Dr. Ronnie Jackson, the man President Trump wants in next? He is a veteran. He was a Navy Rear Admiral. Tell us about what his charge is going to be and who he is.
That's right. So Dr. Jackson has actually been at the White House as a doctor or chief doctor for something like 12 or 13 years. He worked for George W. Bush. He was President Obama's personal doctor for 8 years. Everyone we've talked to says he is a very affable doctor, very affable guy, very clearly interested in public service, gregarious, competent. But the question is, is he prepared to run an organization like this with 360,000 employees and, the government's largest health system? And I think the question is no, although one could argue that no one's ever prepared to run VA. The other issue about Dr. Jackson is that it is really unknown because he has been in a role that is really apolitical throughout his career. It is unknown what his politics are and where he stands on the crucial issues at VA, in particular this tension over privatization.
So we don't know where he stands on that. Do we know for sure where President Trump stands on privatization?
Yeah. So during his campaign, President Trump said that he very much favored giving veterans the ability to choose their private doctors. At one point, he did say something along the lines of, let's give them a card, like Medicare, so that they can present it to a doctor and, use a card and the government will pay for it. I think the president and his aides have realized that it's far more complicated, to do that now. And it's also extremely costly to just give veterans, have the government pay for veterans to be to see private doctors whenever they can. I don't think we are heading toward a completely privatized system. I think that that is just not plausible. But the issue that Dr. Jackson will be dealing with is how far do you go? There will be pressures from the traditional veterans groups not to go further than the agency has now gone. And there will be pressure from the president and his supporters who favor this kind of shift in policy to do more. Right now, about 30% of veterans actually do see private doctors outside VA.
Okay. A lot more to talk about. Lisa Ryan, federal reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, now to northern Iraq, which is emerging from a three-year battle against ISIS. A small band of medical workers is in the remote area of Sinjar, treating members of the Yazidi religious minority. The Yazidis suffered massacres, kidnapping, and displacement by ISIS until ISIS was forced out last year. Still, few aid workers have stepped in to help. NPR's Jane Araf went to a small hospital where a different breed of aid worker is trying to fill the gap.
Okay, the first one, please. Oh, at last. Welcome. Tell me.
Dr. Marino Andolina, an Italian pediatrician, is seeing his first patient of the morning. The generator is broken, and it's dark in the only hospital in the town of Sinjar, home to thousands of Yazidis. They work by the light of a flashlight. Worse, though, is the cold.
The thing is, you can't undress a baby when it's so cold. So we can't do the ultrasound, and we're having to tell them, please come back next week when hopefully we may have some heating.
That's Sally Becker, who founded the tiny aid organization Road to Peace. This is a remote corner of northern Iraq, and these are unconventional volunteers. In 1993, Becker was an artist living in Spain when she saw a TV report from Bosnia that changed her life.
There was a woman in Sarajevo trying to cross the street with all the snipers and everything, and she turned to the cameras and she said, why is no one helping us? And they went in close up and I saw her face and I felt she was talking to me, you know, and I thought, I'm that someone who's doing nothing. So I decided to try and help.
Becker, who was British, became known as the Angel of Mostar for driving wounded children across the Balkans' front line. She did the same last year in the battle against ISIS in Mosul. And now she's back in a place where major aid organizations are mostly absent.
The bigger organizations, they are much more bureaucratic. They need permissions. They need special authorizations from all kinds of people, whereas we go in and then we apply for the authorization.
Here it's just Becker, an American aid worker providing logistical help, and Andolina. It's a low-budget organization funded by donations, and they all work for free. They pay five local medical staff. Andolina is 72 years old. He's been volunteering in conflict zones for three decades, and he's a bit of a renegade.
I experienced what is medicine in Europe, mainly in Italy. Corruption, obedience to protocol, think first to your safety and not the one of the patient. Think to insurance, lawyers, judges, courts. Sad life for a daughter of my age.
Come on.
Okay. Next one.
In the aftermath of war, amid crushing poverty, almost every case is a challenge. 10-year-old Saad has been bleeding from his nose and mouth. And Alina says he has an autoimmune disease.
Could be lethal. Prone to die if we're not able to find a solution. I tried to send him to another laboratory to check the number of platelets, but it seems that the mother failed. Why she didn't go? Matter of money, the laboratory was not available. Why?
Road to Peace had agreed to pay two ambulance drivers, but the ambulance the Iraqi health ministry has promised has never materialized. The staff dig into their own pockets to pay taxi fare for patients. Andolina does have a couple of high-tech tools. One is a handheld ultrasound machine. In the cold, he does a quick scan of a little girl's kidney.
Well, one kidney was not perfect, but I had no time since she was freezing.
He orders some blood tests. For particularly complicated cases, Becker has compiled a group of volunteer specialists, reachable online for consultations. She sends them photos by WhatsApp. Someone usually responds within minutes.
This boy is 12 or 13 years old. One of the militants threw a small bomb to him. He thought it was a gift. He caught it, it exploded. He lost one arm. He's just got shrapnel wounds all over him.
Becker hopes to send him abroad for surgery. And in his cold, dark room, Angelina asks for the next patient.
The name of the girl?
And after her, there's still a long, long line of sick children and desperate parents waiting to see a pediatrician desperate to make a difference. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Sinjar, Northern Iraq.
Oklahoma just did something many political watchers didn't think was possible. The Republican-controlled legislature approved a tax increase to give teachers a pay raise. Teachers in the state say they need more money, and they'll stick to their planned walkout next week. The Department of Education is just one state agency that's contending with a worsening budget crisis after years of tax cuts didn't have the results state lawmakers were hoping for. And so even Republicans are now saying yes to tax increases. Before this week's vote, I spoke with Leslie Osborne, a Republican Oklahoma state representative who had a change of heart on tax cuts. And I asked her, aside from the teachers, where she was noticing the pain from lack of revenue.
Well, last year when I was appropriations chair in the House, I had a budget compiled on what we had actually done in cuts to our main core services in the last decade. And what it came up with was rather shocking, except for the top two or three agencies, which would be the healthcare entities, Department of Human Services, Education. What we had done is we have cut the other 85% of our agencies an average of 45% in the last decade. Now, the first 15 or 20%, they may have been at a level where they needed to find some efficiencies, some streamlining, some public-private partnerships, but the last 15, 20% of those cuts have been devastating. So what we're seeing is not enough foster care workers. Where Medicaid provider rates are perilously low so that we are going to face closing rural hospitals and nursing homes. It's a true crisis.
Have any agencies actually completely run out of money?
No, because, you know, we actually have a balanced budget amendment in Oklahoma, which is a good thing. We'll never get in the trouble that the federal government is, but that means we do make the cuts. Unfortunately, what it means if they did run out of money in any of these years when we were making these massive cuts is that they basically just discontinued certain programs and prioritized the others. Now, like I said, the original ones, as a Republican, I can say at the very beginning, I think there were some things we needed to do. But we went too far, and at this point, we have not only cut out the fat, we're down to bleeding out level.
How did it get to this point? Is this all about the tax cuts?
I would call it a perfect storm. If you look at the last decade, what we did is we lowered taxes multiple times down to 5%. Remember that the first three, four tax cuts were done by a Republican legislature but signed by a Democrat governor. So we had some bipartisan support. We were looking for that dynamic effect. If you cut taxes, that people will hire more people in their businesses. They'll buy more equipment. The economy will thrive. You'll see a dynamic effect economically. I believe that worked the first couple of times. But then what we did is we weren't looking at all the facts. We were trying to cut taxes to match Texas. Kansas and Oklahoma were doing this together. But what we weren't doing was the rest of the story. The rest of the story is Texas's property taxes, 2 to 3 times higher than ours. Texas taxes services, we don't. Texas taxes mineral rights, we don't. So when you aren't looking at a complete picture, we were cutting too far without all the facts. Now, after getting in and educating myself, I realized that several people had been right. So about 3 years ago, we started hearing from the treasurer, Ken Miller. He was telling us, guys, wait a minute. This experiment needs to be stopped. The second was the Secretary of Finance, Preston Dorflinger, then the governor. And I was rather vocal last year as the appropriations chair that even as a Republican, we had gone too far and it was time to start investing again in Oklahoma and trying to right the ship.
And you were ousted as the appropriations chair.
Yes, because some believed that I went too far, that calling for revenue increases, even though it was never back to the point of where we started, made me a bad Republican. I personally like to believe that it made me a good Oklahoman. Because if you invest in your future, your children, classroom sizes, teacher salaries, mental health funding, prison programming, those small buckets of money you invest in targeted areas pay off exponentially in lives and dollars down the road.
You mentioned Kansas. We've done some reporting from Kansas about what happened there, where they implemented very steep tax cuts and in the end ended up with way too little revenue to deal with all the things that the state needs to pay for, and the Republican-controlled legislature there did decide to override the governor's veto and get rid of some of those tax cuts. Do you see a similarity to what happened in Kansas?
Yes, absolutely. So I was with a group that a conservative think tank took us to meet with Governor Brown back when all of these tax cuts were being discussed. Now, thank goodness, even though our problems are dire, we didn't enact the tax cuts at the huge level they did, which was several percentage points overnight. Now, what I would say is last year, the irony is we did push a lot of bills through that were not what you call a true tax increase, because we have the hardest margin of any state in the nation to pass revenue, a 75% vote, a three-quarters vote in the legislature, which is virtually impossible. A taxpayer group did that as an initiative petition decades ago, and it's made it impossible. Unfortunately, you can lower taxes with a simple majority. So,
is there any way to get rid of that law?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the rub. It's in our Constitution. So it has to go through in one of two ways and be voted on by the people. Will the people be educated enough to understand what we did? Because a lot of times when I talked about raising revenue, the average citizen, which is what I was out running a business before I ran for the legislature, aren't even aware that we cut taxes so many times, that we created the problem and that we're only trying to go back and right the ship. I think that the teacher crisis, the education crisis, what we've done with the appalling lack of dollars sent to common education is the one thing that might make us do that. So there's two bills that are still live rounds in the House and Senate that could potentially put on the ballot, changing us from either a three-fourths to a two-thirds or another one that has some other similar measures.
So what do you say to your colleagues who don't want to raise taxes right now? I mean, how do you explain to them what you're feeling, which is that the state's in a dire situation? And I know you're against raising taxes, but you got to do it this time.
You know, it's all about education. When I came in a decade ago, this is my 10th and last year in the legislature because I'm leaving to run for a statewide office. But that being said, when we came in, we had 85 agencies. We're down to 67. So see, we've already streamlined, consolidated. We found public-private partnerships. When I came in, we had 35,000 state employees. We're down to 28,000, but with the same workload because we have a growing population and new laws. All that shows that we have done the work. Yet you hear the far-right rhetoric that says, well, we just need to tighten the belt. Guys, we've tightened the belt way past the first notch. Now, that never means that you don't continue to look for efficiencies. But if you look at those facts, then you realize you're only dealing with an ideologue.
You're running for labor commissioner. Is this a good issue for you to run on, or is it tough in Oklahoma to run and say we got to raise taxes?
Well, now remember, as a Republican, you don't ever want to say you. I do want to stress that we need to continue looking in particular for public-private partnerships and any kind of efficiencies we can find. What I'm saying is we may need to raise some base revenues back to a portion of where they were before for targeted investment. And absolutely, is that a popular, perfect message for a Republican? Well, it depends what kind of Republican you are.
So we're talking to you about what's going on in Oklahoma, but people may listen to it and say this sounds familiar to what's happening in Washington. A huge tax cut package just passed and not paid for. What do you think the message is to Washington, or what would you say about those tax cuts?
Okay, so this is an interesting dynamic. So here's the difference. We have a balanced budget amendment. That means when the Equalization Board comes in from the Tax Commission and gives us our numbers prior to building our fiscal year budget every year, they're going to tell us exactly how much we're in the hole or how much extra we have to spend or save. We have to make that balance by either raising revenue or cutting agencies. The federal government does not have those parameters, hence why we see constantly these huge deficits. So that means that if the tax cuts there don't work, then that we will see increased deficit spending unless they want to do something on things like entitlement programs. Now, here I have also been visiting the last month with several members of the Nebraska legislature because they are going through the same thing that we did. They're being pushed heavily to lower taxes, lower income taxes, lower income taxes. And I've been talking to them about the perils of making sure that you are comparing apples with apples, that you're looking at everything your contiguous states are doing and not just the one parameter of income tax. Look at things like property and motor fuels and the other things so that you're getting a clear picture.
So it doesn't sound like you would say, don't do the tax cuts in Washington.
Well, I will tell you one thing I have absolutely no desire to do is ever be a federal congresswoman. So that's above my purview, but I would say to be cautious. Now, in Oklahoma, I know we need to redo our tax code. It hasn't been modernized since the 30s, and it's still built on a model that is different from what we are now. We need a strong new governor to come in this fall and say, guys, we need to totally modernize our tax code in Oklahoma.
You think that'll happen?
I hope so. I think it's a pivotal time for a strong governor to come in and say, guys, it's time to turn this around. We cannot be complacent about being 49th, 50th in all these indicators. We have to have a vision for our future.
That's Leslie Osborne, a Republican Oklahoma state representative. Representative Osborne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the time.
And again, after our conversation, Oklahoma's legislature did pass a tax increase to help fund pay raises for teachers. Three quarters of the legislature had to approve it. In the Senate, it passed by one vote. The governor says she'll sign it. Your thoughts welcome at hereandnow.org.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you're worried about being audited by the IRS, you can probably rest a little easier. According to data being released today, IRS personal tax audits have dropped to their lowest level since 2002. That has a lot to do with the big budget cuts the agency has faced in recent years. Since 2010, the IRS has cut about a third of its employees who enforce tax law. Charisse Jones of USA Today joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
And what percentage of taxpayers are getting audited right now, and how does it compare to past years?
So about 0.62% of taxpayers were audited last year. And, that's, the lowest since 2002. And it's about 1 in 160 Americans as compared to 1 in 90 in 2010, which was a high point for the decade. And the really rich really did well. If you were making more than $1 million, about 4% of those income earners were audited last year, which was the lowest since 2004. But pretty much across the board, people didn't have to worry as much about the government saying, I've got to take a closer look at your taxes.
What do fewer audits mean for revenue? Does the IRS make a lot of money finding taxes that people didn't pay during these audits?
You know, it's significant because the revenue that comes from individual taxpayers makes up the lion's share of the receipts that are taken in by the federal government, about 48%, which is up from 45% a couple of years ago. So it's really the money that keeps the government moving, that makes the wheels turn. And when you have less revenue coming in, that can be a real problem.
Now, President Trump has called for more cuts to the IRS. And in 2017, funding for the IRS was down 8% from a high in 2010. Why have they been cutting it back so much?
You know, the GOP was really at war with President Obama. And during his term, they slashed the IRS repeatedly, especially in 2013 when they found out from a report that the IRS was being a little bit harder on conservative groups that were seeking a tax-exempt status. And so, you know, their applications were being delayed. They weren't getting approved as often. So the GOP just kept cutting. They also said that the agency was wasteful, the service wasn't very good, that there were cybersecurity issues. But now the GOP is in power. There's a Republican president, and they've passed this huge tax bill, which is their signature piece of legislation. So they're feeling a little bit more generous.
Yeah, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has called for more funding for the IRS so that they can deal with the new tax law. And, you know, is that going to help deal with audits? Is that going to be a big priority, or is this just going to be for the tax law?
It's really for the tax law. I mean, they didn't get as much money as they wanted. It's about $320 million. And they have to, there's a stipulation that they've got to put in a budget. They've got to say how they're going to spend that money specifically for the tax law. So the idea that it might be, you know, siphoned off for auditing is unlikely. So I guess people that get hired to do this might eventually do that. But right now it's really focused on the tax legislation.
Have you done your taxes yet, Charisse?
I did. My dad always helps me, so I'm really good about that.
That's Charisse Jones of USA Today. Charisse, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This fall marks the 50th anniversary of the release of Van Morrison's Astral Weeks. The album was greeted with little fanfare, and it's never been a top seller, but it's regarded as one of the most original and important records of the rock era, one of the top 20 albums of all time, says Rolling Stone magazine. Astral Weeks was recorded in New York and is full of references to Morrison's native Ireland. A new book argues, though, that the musical roots of the album lie in the relatively short time that Morrison spent living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Producer Jeremy Goodwin has more.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream.
Astral Weeks is a strange and beguiling album. It's hypnotic. The song structures are loose, and Morrison keeps going into these stream-of-consciousness reveries for minutes at a time. He's singing about memory, lost love, rebirth.
Would you kiss my eyes? Laying it down. Silence is the ache to be born again.
Such a hard record to talk about. Yeah, and even on my subway ride here, I was like, oh, I gotta talk about Astral Weeks. And I was like, God, how do you talk about Astral Week?
That's Amanda Petrusich. She writes about music and culture for The New Yorker.
Van Morrison's talked about this record really being him channeling some sort of astral impulse or channeling some other energy that is sort of sourced from somewhere outside of him, which seems crazy, but also you listen to this record more and more, you think, all right, maybe that's true. I mean, I don't know how else a person gets to the place where they're confidently making music that sounds like no other music on earth at age 22.
It didn't sound like anything else on the radio or anything Morrison had done before. It was a total break from the rough-edged rock he'd made with his group Them and the perfect pop of Brown Eyed Girl, a top 10 hit the year before.
The Johnson says, hey, love, you forgot your love. And the love that loves the love that loves the love that loves the love that loves to love the love that loves to love the love that loves. Say goodbye to Madam Joy.
So, where did Astral Weeks come from?
Dry your eye from Madam Joy.
8 months before he cut the record, Morrison moved from New York to Cambridge, Massachusetts. For decades, this fact was a little-noticed footnote. The album's lyrics are filled with references to Belfast, Ireland, so the enigmatic poem on the back cover, which references several places in Massachusetts, it always seemed out of place. Enter Boston musician Ryan Walsh.
I'm a songwriter, singer, guitarist.
Walsh has written a new book that argues for the importance of Morrison's Bay State detour in the birth of the Astral Weeks sound. Walsh uncovered the one song from the recording sessions that didn't make the album. It was a missing musical link between Astral Weeks and the Irishman's heretofore uncelebrated time living in Cambridge.
In the middle of it, suddenly, Morrison is singing about the Cape in Cambridgeport and Hyannis. And I said, oh my God, this is the poem on the back sleeve of Astral Weeks. It was in this song that got cut from the album. I did get teary-eyed.
It turns out Morrison was on Cape Cod a few times that summer. He played straightforward rock shows at places like a converted church there and an amusement park in Rhode Island. But at some point, he changed musical direction. Drummer John Sheldon told Walsh that Morrison explained he got the idea to ditch electric guitars and go acoustic from a dream. Morrison's bass player at the time, Tom Kilbanya, has a less astral and a more down-to-earth explanation.
We were playing at the Catacombs, and I had a problem with my amp, and it wasn't working, and we didn't have time to fix it, so I went up to my apartment, and I got my acoustic bass. And the whole thing kind of like went acoustic after that. On a blue ocean against tomorrow's
sky. Kilbanya would quit music a year later, and then worked for 44 years at a print shop. But in 1968, he was a student at Berklee College of Music. That spring and summer, he would head across the Charles River to help Morrison work out his new material in Van's tiny kitchen.
I took my bass on a bus, my acoustic bass. I took it on a bus, and I get in the house, and he says, I had this idea for this song last night in my sleep. We started doing Moon Dance, and that's the way things were. He would get these ideas, and he would come up with them, and we started working on Moon Dance.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes.
Moondance wouldn't make the Astral Weeks album, but Kilbanya says he wrote that jazz bass line that's been a part of the song ever since.
All the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow.
The rest of the world didn't know yet, but Morrison had set off in the direction that would result in the unmistakable sound of Astral Weeks. With a new musical concept, Morrison needed new bandmates.
I met this bass player named Tom Kilbanya, who said he was playing with this guy named Van Morrison. And they're looking for a flute player. So I went down there.
That's John Payne, a jazz musician who was taking a break from Harvard at the time. It was an instant musical meld, though Payne still hadn't connected the dots and realized just who he was playing with.
I could tell he was hearing what I was playing and reacting to it in his phrasing.
Saw you early this morning. With your brand new boy and your Cadillac.
And the second song that he started was Brown Eyed Girl. And after a few seconds I realized, he's not covering this tune. This is just this guy's tune. What's he doing in this coffee house, you know, with 40 people in attendance?
Among them was a music reviewer named Eric Kraft. He was there because the underground paper he wrote for got an intriguing tip.
Someone wrote a letter saying, the world's greatest musician is living in Cambridge and will be playing at the Catacombs starting next Wednesday. And the arts editor said, I don't know, this may be insane, but I think you ought to go hear this guy.
And I know you know it too.
Kraft saw Morrison play 5 shows in the tiny basement club that month. Each night was different.
I was seeing the creation of the material, the revision of it, the rethinking, the remaking of it. Once I realized that that was what I was witnessing, that I was in the artist's studio.
All right. Well, it's getting late. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Even on the album, the songs feel like living organisms. Morrison's vocals are almost like verbal saxophone solos. He stretches words and flutters around the melody. It all channels a sense of nostalgic obsession. It's this element that really hits the gut of the New Yorker's Amanda Petrusich.
So much of what he does on this record isn't about language at all. It's those kind of wild, hypnotic repetitions where he comes to sound almost pre-verbal. You know, it's as if he's dissolving right in front of you. And the actual literal meaning of the words just begins to feel irrelevant. And it's about the sound of his voice and the way in which he's, you know, repeating those phrases. It's what it does musically, I just find, you know, to be totally devastating. Just like a ballerina, I just like a tittle.
Morrison recorded the album just a few weeks after those first shows with John Payne on flute. Astral Weeks hit stores a month later. It was barely promoted, and few people heard it at the time. But history has been very kind. In 2012, Rolling Stone magazine listed it among the 20 greatest albums of all time. And from Belfast to Boston, many of us agree. For Here Now, I'm Jeremy Goodwin.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is likely to yield to Congress's request that he appear before them soon to answer questions about the Cambridge Analytica data leak. Lawmakers are also calling on tech company CEOs from Twitter and Google to respond to questions about what they do with user data. We've seen other major figures appear at congressional hearings in recent months, from Equifax, Wells Fargo, and Amtrak. But largely absent from such hearings, Big Pharma. That's even as the cost of pharmaceutical drugs has soared. At least 20 drugs cost over 200% more than they did just 14 months ago. Aaron Mershon has looked into why Congress has called on so few pharmaceutical company captains to account for their actions. She's a politics and policy reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Aaron.
Hi there, Lisa. How are you?
So the hikes in prices cause outrage, they cause hardship, and they make lots and lots of headlines. But apparently, none of that has prompted Congress to call Big Pharma CEOs into account and have them come before Congress. Why not?
You know, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. First of all, you know, there's a difference between holding a hearing on the issue broadly and calling in a specific CEO. And I think, first of all, that these CEOs, they don't want to come in. They don't want to give this testimony. It can be embarrassing. It can be a tough day.
It's a spectacle.
For any CEO. It's a spectacle. It is. And I think also, I think Congress struggles a little bit with determining exactly which company to bring in. You know, when it's an entire industry that's at least raising prices, some slowly, some sort of more quickly, but it's still an entire industry. It's hard to sort of single out one company or at least determine which company to single out.
So that's why the main trade industry, as you note, has indeed come before Congress and spoken, at least, as you say, in both chambers three times in the last 6 months. Is that not sufficient?
You know, I think it depends on who you ask. I think certainly for the lawmakers who are holding these hearings, they have preferred to call in the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association representatives to sort of defend the entire industry as a whole. But I think there are others who say, you know, there are specific companies whose specific price hikes are worth examining further, and it's important to get these people on the record about what's going on. I think it depends on who you ask.
So this is an issue of individual culpability. When is the last time that somebody from a drug company, a CEO, has spoken before Congress, testified?
So I think most famously, about 2 years ago, Congress called in Martin Shkreli, the sort of pharma bro who hiked the price of Daraprim by 5,000% and sparked huge outrage. And then a little while later that year, Mylan CEO Heather Bresch came before Congress to testify about price hikes for the EpiPen, which is obviously, you know, another big controversy in the drug pricing world.
And what did that accomplish in both cases?
In Shkreli's case, his hearing was very much a spectacle. He decided to plead the fifth for the entire day, sort of smirked, I think, made a lot of members very angry. In Heather Bresch's case, it's a little more interesting. She came in, she gave her testimony, I think, pledged to do her best to get more customers access to the EpiPen. But about a year after that testimony, I think people looked at the issue and the EpiPen prices were still quite high.
So then does testifying before Congress accomplish anything?
I think it depends on who you ask. I think, you know, in a time when Congress really has shown itself relatively unable to really come together, to agree, to do anything, particularly on drug prices, it's not that we've seen major legislation moving forward in a meaningful way on this issue. They don't have a solution. And so I think there are a lot of people who feel that public pressure and that putting a spotlight on this issue, that action, that oversight activity can really make a difference, can raise attention, can raise awareness, and can shame a company into making changes in a way that obviously they're not doing right now legislatively.
Yeah, the question is, does it produce actually lower drug prices? And I know you spoke with somebody who's a patient advocate who said this is not really the way to accomplish what they want, which is lower drug prices.
Yeah, I spoke with Ben Wakana, who's the executive director of Patients for Affordable Drugs, and I think he had a pretty pithy quote here that he didn't really want CEOs to come up and reiterate talking points that he said were, quote, warmed over garbage that can be debunked by a middle schooler with Google. And I think that's a position of many who want to see Congress really pass a law, do something that could make meaningful change for an entire industry, rather than calling in one CEO or 10 CEOs to talk about the prices that they've put forward for their products.
Yeah, so given the fact that we've had Equifax, Wells Fargo, Amtrak appear before Congress, given the fact that President Trump himself has made an issue of high drug prices, why is Congress reluctant now to call anybody forward?
So I think Republicans and Democrats in Congress are absolutely interested in the issue of drug prices, or at least in talking about it. We do see bipartisan tirades on this. Everyone is sort of outraged, broadly speaking, about the high drug prices. And you have absolutely heard those calls from President Trump himself, too. I think the difference is whether to call in a CEO or sort of choosing how to deal with the problem. And I think that's where you see a difference based on a given member's politics, a given member's preferences. And I think right now, Republican chairmen in particular who are running these committees, who are making these decisions about what kind of hearings to have and what kind of issues to examine, they're really interested in sort of exploring the issue, fact-finding, sort of the very early stages of what we might sort of turn into down the road a legislative process. They're really, you know, trying to figure out the breadth of the problem, who's at fault, asking the kind of questions that I think frustrate advocates who really want to see prices come down faster because they said, you know, enough fact-finding, let's get something done now.
Okay, Erin Mershon, politics and policy reporter at STAT, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.